All right, we will start. Good morning. This is a meeting of the Stationary Source Committee of the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. May we have roll call?
On the roll for the Stationary Source Committee meeting of December 18th, 2017, Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Groom.
Present.
Director Haggerty. Director Miley. Director Mitchoff. Director Sparing. Director Wagenknecht.
Here.
Committee Vice Chair Sinks.
Here.
Committee Chair Joya.
Here.
Chair Niss. We have a quorum.
Great. We're here. All right. With that, Liz, would you like to lead us in the Pledge of the Flag since you are our chair and you're here?
Absolutely.
All right, our first item is public comment, which is the chance for the public to speak on items not on our agenda. We cannot act. Is there any public comment? Okay, seeing none, approval of the minutes of the September 18th meeting.
I'll move the minutes. Second.
Motion a second. All in favor? Aye. All right. We have two presentations today. Our first one, item four, is rule development addressing particulate matter. So we will get an update on a current rule under development.
So Chair Joy and members of the Stationary Source Committee this morning, Greg Nudd, new Deputy Air Pollution Control Officer for Policy, will give a presentation on rule development that we've been working on for quite a while to update our particulate matter rules. And we hope to bring these rules to the board for consideration for action in February. Greg.
Chair Joya and members of the committee, as Jean said, I'm going to give an update on our particulate matter rulemaking. So I'll start off with a little particulate matter basics, kind of particulate matter 101. Then we'll talk about health impacts, trends, sources, rulemaking, and next steps. So particulate matter comes in lots of sizes. We're typically concerned about the fine PM. That's the 2.5 micrometers or less. The smaller particles have a tendency to go deeper into your lungs and into your bloodstream, and those are the ones that cause most of the problems. The most significant issue with particulate matter is premature mortality. It's been shown pretty consistently that high PM2.5 levels lead to higher death rates. Our estimates in the Clean Air Plan is that PM2.5, even at our levels below the federal health standards, still account for 2,000 to 3,000 premature deaths in the Bay Area each year. High PM levels also are linked to asthma and bronchitis, and then it's the cardiovascular problems that usually result in the premature mortality. The diesel PM is probably the biggest cancer driver in the Bay Area from an air pollution standpoint. This chart compares the health burden, this is from the Clean Air Plan, of all of the pollutants that we regulate from an air pollution standpoint. You can see that the mortality is largely driven by PM2.5 other than diesel PM, although diesel PM is still a significant issue. So this is the plan that we had for PM in the 2010 Clean Air Plan. It was recently updated and expanded. And this project is the general PM project, and it's kind of a starting point to clean up our old regulations, modernize them, and lay the groundwork for more source-specific regulations that we'll have coming up. Here's where we are in terms of air quality trends. We have been below the federal standard for the past several years, and I think that's probably largely due to the wood smoke rule and the success with that, as well as reduction in emissions from vehicles.
Can you, before you move off this chart, explain how it's measured, where it's measured, the units? I think because, right, PM tend to have
right.
localized impacts, so
right.
There's many sources of PM. Explain this chart.
Sure, I will have to go into that. So this chart refers to the annual PM 2.5 concentration. The number on the bar chart is the peak annual concentration. And the design value, the DV, is kind of a statistically constructed number that's intended to account for excursions due to equipment issues.
I'm not sure I understand. Phase. When you say the peak, because
right.
peak at a cumulative sort of inventory of PM sources? Or
no, this is actual measured data, Chair Gioia. So this is ambient concentration data. And when I say peak, I'm meaning the highest annual average anywhere in our regional network.
So you look at individual measuring stations around the Bay Area.
That's correct.
And then this is the...
The worst case for that year.
The worst case.
For that year.
Averaging among all the sites?
No, it's an annual average at that particular site. So there are a couple of health standards. One is for chronic exposure, which is
right.
the annual average, and one is for acute exposure, which is the 24-hour standard. So this is for the annual, the acute exposure.
Where can you identify the sites?
Chronic, yeah, sorry.
Do you have a list of the sites of somewhere where we...
I can provide that
okay.
to you. Typically, these peaks occur in... Our problematic sites in terms of peak annual average tend to be in San Jose and Napa. So here's the 24-hour.
And I'm sorry, when you're going back again, there's different results winter and summer, right? I mean, this considers winter year-round.
Right, this is the annual average.
Is the geographic area where there is the greatest problem different in the summer than in the winter?
Yes. Is the short answer. There are some parts of the Bay Area that tend to be more subject to short-term high concentrations of PM. A lot of that is driven by influx from the San Joaquin Valley, and you can see kind of the peaks as they go down the Carquinez Strait and hit Vallejo and San Rafael and go up the valley into Napa. And then the wood smoke sites, we have some sites that are heavily impacted by wood smoke more so than others. In terms of chronic exposure, those tend to be more sites that have a lot of local sources, like traffic and stationary sources.
Okay.
So we talked earlier about the annual average, and this is now the 24-hour standard. And so, again, this is the number of exceedances anywhere in our network in a particular year. And the green line is the actual number, and the purple line is the three-year average that kind of smooths out the year-to-year variations driven by weather events. And what you can see is a pretty significant downward trend, one that was accelerated by the board's adoption of the stringent wood smoke rule 6.3.
John, could I
yeah.
ask a question
yeah.
on that? Could you go back?
Sure.
So this is a very impressive slide, don't you think?
I do think. I think we've made great progress in this region.
Yeah, I think we should talk. I mean, this is amazing. I have friends now who actually are talking about the fact that we have a Spare the Air Day. Like, it suddenly has occurred to people they might have something to do with the air quality. And I think that this is so interesting because that is a dramatic dive in 15 years. And I think we should talk about that. I think we should say, hey, this is something got through to people.
Right.
And this is really pretty impressive. So I'm sure nobody here would dare to light their fire if they have one or do their outside barbecue on this group. But I'm beginning to hear other people say, Oh, we couldn't barbecue because it was a spare the air day. That's pretty amazing. They wouldn't have said that 15 years ago.
It's great that message is getting through.
Yeah. Or, you know, just in general that wood smoke really does cause particulate matter and breathing problems.
Absolutely.
So I didn't want a chance to go by without tooting our horn about something that really has made such a difference.
So this gets back to Director Joy's question earlier about the location of the PM monitors. And this one lists the ones that, as I mentioned before, tend to be most heavily impacted by those short-term weather-related events, usually. And as I mentioned, Vallejo and San Jose are top of the list there in terms of the short-term exposure problems. So PM10 is the larger class of PM, a little bit coarser than the PM2.5. More of it gets caught in your body's natural defenses, so it tends to not be as much of a problem here in the Bay Area. This is more of an issue like down in Imperial County or in the desert southwest. And you can see why dust is probably the biggest source of PM10 in the Bay Area. Drilling down to the sources of PM2.5, which are of more concern to us from a health standpoint, you can see that residential wood burning is a huge slice of the pie, and mobile sources are also very large, and industrial processes are about 23%, so close to residential wood burning when you combine it. And commercial cooking is a concern. It's more of a localized concern, though, than a regional concern.
John, can I come back to this again? Because the wood burning is so interesting. And we first brought this up. There were a number of places, especially in North Marin, that were very difficult to deal with because people heat their houses with wood.
Right.
What have we done about that through the years? Because that's been several years now.
In terms of where are we with the wood smoke program in West Marin?
Essentially, have you had success in West Marin?
I think we've taken more of an incentives approach to that, so I don't know if Damien wants to weigh in on that.
Well, there are two elements to that program, as you know, Chair Nis. One is the incentives program that we've put out there and we've targeted. Mm-hmm. You've also authorized us to go forward with an additional $700,000 this year to target more those care communities and these communities that are heavily impacted by wood smoke. And the other element of that program is our regulatory efforts. So we've stepped up enforcement, we've stepped up patrols in those areas, and we've also changed the regulation and how it works. So those communities now with those sole sources of heat, they're required to upgrade to EPA certified stoves. And then eventually we're hoping in those areas that we'll be able to convert them. So I don't know if Wayne wants to add to my comments. Wayne Keno, our Director of Enforcement and new deputy in charge of operations.
And the real question is it gaining ground? Is it being successful?
I think so. In addition to that, we also provided money to Marin to help incentivize change outs there too. So we gave some money for their programs also. And they tend to target that area a bit more than we can. So, with all the things that Mr. Breen talked about, plus the enforcement, plus all the incentives, plus the outreach that we do, it's been effective, and we look forward to doing more.
So if you look at this as 25% is residential wood burning, what was it, say, 8 years ago?
On peak days, I think we've seen the impacts from this be as high as, 35, 40% of the total. So we're seeing it come down. And Wayne, I think, also has some statistics on the amount of wood sales that we're seeing. So they are also trending downwards as well. So we believe we're having an impact. We're continuing to monitor. And we are pushing this down. So as the rule gets fully implemented, we're hoping that this fraction will also reduce over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a big thrust to reach out to that community. Thanks.
Just so on-road motor vehicles are presumably mostly diesel trucks.
I wouldn't make that assumption.
Where would diesel trucks come?
Well, that,
but
would,
that would be in
they
this
would
category.
Be a component of on-road motor vehicles, yeah.
Right.
I think you'd see, if you're looking at black carbon, you'd see
right.
a lot more of that coming from the on-road diesel trucks. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers before I would could tell you how much of that was.
But the diesel trucks would be counted within that 12%.
Yes, of the on-road,
yeah.
right?
So yeah, and diesel generators would be?
Under the industrial combustion.
Industrial combustion. And other mobile sources, what would that be?
Construction equipment, farm
agricultural
equipment,
construction
like
equipment, right?
Right, and marine, which is a big part of that.
Like a ship,
ocean-going vessels,
right,
harbor
right,
craft.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So this includes emissions, not just at the dock of running a generator, but emissions transiting the bay.
Correct.
And sitting in the bay.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Rod, you had a question.
I was just wondering if you could comment a bit on what of these PM sources are most injurious to human health? You've talked about carcinogens associated with diesel. What do we know about the problems with these? You know, if I was to take industrial combustion or accidental fires or dust, are they as harmful, or do they cause other conditions such as heart and lung illness?
The data that's available right now is...
Well, okay.
I hear that all the time.
And I'll ask Greg Dunn,
next,
the
next question, please.
Actually, Siri kind of nailed it. So
I'm sure Greg can help me.
We're having a very interesting discussion on that topic in the advisory council.
Right.
Right. So the science is not entirely clear. What
okay.
we have is micrograms per cubic meter measured in the atmosphere, and on the other hand, hospital admissions data and health data. So the micrograms per cubic meter doesn't differentiate between dust or motor vehicle exhaust. So at this point, we're not sure. There have been some studies that show that the organic components tend mm-hmm. to be the ones that are the most harmful, but it's unclear as to whether or not if something starts out as carbon, it becomes worse than something that might start out as dust and then have carbon compounds accrete on it in the atmosphere. And I don't know if you want to add anything.
There was a significant study in New England Journal of Medicine in June, done by Harvard Public Health, and it was not differentiating between the particular species of particulate matter. You know, there's a lot of different types of chemicals that make up particulate matter, but it was showing that based on long-term study of Medicare data, so that would be mostly elderly adults, that there was increased mortality associated with each increment of 10 micrograms per cubic meter. Of measured particulate.
So, and that was an unspeciated, all things, all particles in study.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Typically, the way we monitor for it, it's in micrograms of whatever. It's just weight over volume.
Yeah. Well, I'll point out for my colleagues in listening to Michael Kleinman at our last advisory council meeting, he really is. We're lucky to have him helping us here because he is doing some world-class leading research mm-hmm. down at Irvine on speciation and, you know, what it could mean. So if we got to a point where we were singling out the worst offenders, perhaps we could focus on them or the particular industries or processes that are generating them. So thank you.
Yeah, if we can get there, that'd be an interesting policy approach. Okay, taking a step back to the upcoming rulemaking. As I mentioned before, this is really a cleanup. Our Reg 6 rules haven't been updated in a long time. and they set standards for total suspended particulates and things like that. I think there was even a provision in there about how you're not allowed to have burning embers fall on your neighbor. So that's how old this rule is, and it's a logical first step.
How old is that? How old?
That comes from right from the start. So it's the single particulates where you would be burning trash in your backyard. You couldn't have any of that go onto your neighbor's backyard. So right from the very beginning.
So that's still in this rule. That's how old this rule is, how long it's been since it's been updated. So this breaks down the sources in terms of tons per day. Road dust is, you can see both PM10 and PM2.5. Road dust is significant. That includes brake and tire wear, and then dust that gets blown onto the road and then re-entrained by the tires. So it's very significant for PM10. It remains significant even for PM2.5. Construction dust is still significant, and industrial, and you can see the breakdown of the other components there.
Right. I'd say the finer the particulate matter, the more it gets into our lungs and
therefore
possibly the bloodstream, right?
And therefore the more health impact.
Right.
So how do we control for PM? If you're burning natural gas, that's a really good start, but there's still things that can be done. You can improve the burner design. There are things you can do with good combustion practices. Same thing for other gases, burner design, good combustion practices, better oxidation in the combustion process. And then you can also reduce combustion through efficiency measures, and that's what we were looking into with our combustion strategy and the clean air plan. For industrial commercial processes, this is largely material handling. And so you want to do dust control where the solids are exposed to the wind, and you're going to look for truck traffic because it tends to grind up that dust and entrain it in the atmosphere. And then for when you have solids handling that you can run through some kind of stack, you can use wet scrubbers and bag houses. For road dust, the best thing is to just keep it off the streets so that it doesn't get ground up by the tires and entrained. So bulk materials and construction dust. A big problem is wind erosion from the piles and conveyors. And you can use windscreens, you can use water. In this rule, we're not requiring any either of those in particular. We're setting more of a performance-based standard. Truck traffic is a significant source of dust, both within the facilities and through track out and carry out. So going back to what I said before, we want to fix this regulation, make it clean, get us set up for the next round of more aggressive particulate matter regulations. So we're going to create a new umbrella regulation, Regulation 6, and it's going to be the home for all the consistent definitions and test methods for current and future PM rules. And that just makes the rules easier to interpret, easier to enforce, easier for both the folks who have to comply with it and our staff that have to make sure that they do comply with it. So we're going to amend Regulation 6, Rule 1, General Requirements, to include bulk material storage and handling. And we want to clean up those sources like construction sites and quarries and things like that. We're putting forward a new Regulation 6, Rule 6, to prohibit track out. And like I said, this is to set the groundwork for a series of future rules on other sources of PM. We just wanted to get those big sources that you saw in the inventory slide a few slides back. So, as I said before, this is currently a total suspended particulates rule. That's how old it is. It's before we even started differentiating the size of particulates. We want to tighten those general limits to make them as stringent as other jurisdictions in California. We looked at translating total suspended particulate to PM10 and or PM2.5 and decided it wasn't really practical because we'd have to go out and test all these sources to try and figure out what that size partitioning is. So we're just going to tighten up on the TSP and leave the PM2.5 requirements for more specific rules. We're specifying test methods for determining compliance, requiring periodic compliance testing, and then before, we'll get into more source-specific rules next. So here are the bulk material handling requirements. It addresses fugitive dust from all bulk materials, including petroleum coke and coal. So just a kind of a background. If someone were to build a new bulk material handling facility or significantly modify an existing one, they would be subject to best available control technology. That is part of our permitting rules, and this has been established at other facilities in the Bay Area, as including covering transportation vehicles and enclosures around all handling, unloading facilities, and then sending that into a bag house, which is the best technology for filterable particulate matter. This particular rule is for existing facilities, and it's a performance-based rule. Rather than specifying exactly what each facility has to do, we just said you can't have any visible dust going past your property line. We don't want to see any significant visible emissions within the facility. We expect that windscreens or water mist systems will need to be installed in some facilities. The compliance will be determined by visibility, looking for dust. The facilities will have to do their own self-monitoring at least twice daily, and they will also be subject to inspection by air district staff. We expect emission reductions of about 0.03 tons per day of PM 2.5 from this rule, because we are getting really at the big stuff here. It's more of a PM 10 rule, but there is a benefit for PM 2.5 as well.
So just a couple of questions on this slide. As you know, one of the issues that get raised consistently across our rules is the issue of self-monitoring by a facility.
Right.
You know, how do we trust that the facility is going to be monitoring at a time that is the right time, right? What are the protocols regarding that? I understand we may have inspectors out there, and is their monitoring data subject to inspection? So talk about that. In other words, if they're self-monitoring,
right,
where are those records being kept? And do we have protocols for how that monitoring occurs? I mean, we have been concerned about that issue generally. So, and then the second point is when you say sources at least once a day, mm-hmm, who determines when that is? Because if you have a facility that is operating at various hours during the day,
right,
say it's bulk handling bulk materials, right? Mm-hmm. And it chooses to do its monitoring at a time when there's not activity going on, and therefore the emissions would potentially be less than when the activity is occurring.
Right. So the way we expect this rule to play out is that there is this requirement for no visible emissions past the fence line.
Speak a little louder, I think.
Sure. Yeah. The way we expect this rule to play out is there is a requirement for no visible emissions past the fence line.
Right.
So in order to meet that standard, when the inspector comes by, they're going to have to take what steps need to be taken to ensure that that doesn't happen, whether it's put in additional windscreens, additional misting. We expect
About covering a facility?
That is an option, but it's not explicitly required for existing facilities in this rule because it's a performance-based rule. So if that's what they have to do to meet that performance standard, then that's what they'll have to do. The idea behind the monitoring is that it makes the facility more aware of what's going on. And there are methods specified in the rule for them to do this monitoring and some guidance as to what time that would happen. And they have to keep records on that to demonstrate that they did that work. It's kind of analogous to something that they have in the Phoenix and Las Vegas area, where they have, for big construction sites, a designated dust manager who's responsible for keeping the dust down. And what that mainly does is make the operator more aware of what they need to do to make sure that they stay in compliance. And so,
right, but I mean, you may have a situation where operators may know what they need to do but just choose not to do it because of the cost to do that. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you're assuming that everyone's sort of motivated in the same way. I mean, it's going to cost more for facilities to, you know, meet requirements. So I still am not sure I understand, mm-hmm, how to ensure that the monitoring is occurring at a time that is a reasonable indicator over a period of time of the dust emissions. Because again, if activities are going on, intense activities, handling equipment, mm-hmm, during the late afternoon and the monitoring is occurring in the morning, you're not going to capture the same data.
Right.
But, so how do we address that?
Well, So here's the way we envision this working, right? At some point, our inspectors are going to be there checking to ensure that they're complying with this rule. If they don't have the controls in place to comply with this rule, then they're going to get a ticket from the inspector. So the self-monitoring is a record-keeping requirement to make the facility document that they're doing the right thing during the course of each workday. But it is our inspectors that will determine whether they're in compliance with the rule or not.
So if our inspectors say the monitoring's occurring during these hours, but we're seeing more activity and potential for dust during these other hours, you need to be monitoring during these other hours. We have the ability to do that?
I'd have to go back and check the language of the rule.
Why can't we do that?
Like I said, I'd have to go back and check the language in the rule. That gets into a level of detail I don't recall.
Right.
Maybe Wayne can add something.
I'm just raising what I think the practical issues are going to be. I mean, you've got a cement plant, right, that I don't know, maybe it operates all the time. We have other facilities at the Port of Richmond. And so there's operations go on at varying times. They don't always go on consistently.
Right. Yeah, usually a facility, if we're talking about a facility, they do have somebody that's monitoring dust. This rule simply makes them document it. So they're going to be documenting when they do it, when, you know, at times they do it. What I would expect a facility to be looking at their dust, you know, full time, basically. They have somebody doing that all the time. They're documenting it when there's the most potential for dust, when the wind speed is up, that sort of thing. That's when we would like them to, you know, that's sort of the maximum, right? If we do see it, we will cite them. That is a violation. It makes the facility look at when it's most likely to create dust and put in those dust mitigating.
But can't there be language in the rule that requires them to do the monitoring so that way we can enforce it at times, at various times throughout the day or times when there will be potentially the greatest emissions?
I think that's how we do it through our enforcement capabilities.
So, I'm just trying to understand that will happen here.
Yeah, it will. I think that's how it naturally falls out. You know, if we cite them at 1 o'clock in the, say we do it at 6 o'clock in the evening, something like that, and they look at, it may not necessarily be the time, it may be wind speed and direction, that sort of thing that really drives it. So then they'll start monitoring when those parameters get at their highest. So they'll get, as we go along, we're going to start learning about when the most dust-generating operations plus the conditions, atmospheric conditions, would happen.
So your inspectors can go in and say, gee, you need to be monitoring during this time because we've noticed that these are the times when you may potentially have more dust than at the time you're monitoring.
Yeah,
we have the ability to do that.
Yes, the last time we cited them was when the wind speed was this speed, the direction was this, and you probably need to monitor we're going to be monitoring.
And the last question on this is, I know this is a visible sort of standard. What happens with those operations that may be operating at night, where there may be, emissions at night, but they're not visible?
Right. This is a particular problem for the coke and coal handling facility in Richmond.
That's correct.
And we may need to come back with a specific rule for coke and coal handling to address that particular problem.
Bless you. So this wouldn't necessarily address that, because if someone said, like, if the timing is when they need to handle it for a ship going out and then they do it at night, you may have, and then in the morning people may see dust, but it's already after the fact and you have been unable to measure it, and it's not technically a violation because it's of the opacity.
Right. So this is a general rule for a wide variety of facilities, and the particular approach we're taking, that performance-based approach, may not be appropriate for coke and coal facilities. So as you'll see on the regulatory agenda for 2018, we've added a placeholder there for a coke and coal rule.
The rule that it was done on the South Coast that affected some of the operations at, like, the ports of LA and Long Beach, was what kind of rule was that?
That was more of a prescriptive rule rather than a performance-based rule. It required very particular control methods for particular operations.
And the reason we don't have that?
Because we thought that we've run into problems with performance-based rules in the past where the facility was...
With prescriptive or performance?
I'm sorry, prescriptive, pardon me. Yep. Where the facility was checking off all the boxes, but we still were measuring emissions. So we decided to take a performance-based approach because it's more...
Have you looked at hybrids of prescriptive and performance?
And maybe we'll go that way with the coke and coal rule.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
How does an inspector determine whether there are visible, where there are visible particulate matter emissions? You have an opacity glass or something? You just look with the human eye?
Yeah, they have to be trained and they have to be certified twice a year to basically read dust, smoke, and they have to pass a pretty rigorous test twice a year.
So that any time
they visualize it, it can be cited and we could take penalty action based on that.
So I'm a little bit concerned about how much manpower it takes to do this and whether or not the test is objective or subjective. And I'm wondering if there's technology that might help us. So if you surrounded a large industrial facility with, I don't know, half dozen sensors or something like that around the perimeter, and you know the prevailing wind is coming from the northwest, and you measure a lot more stuff at the southeast corner than the northwest, that might tell you that the facility really is doing something. And I'm wondering if that wouldn't prove a more less labor intensive and more objective way to determine if you got a dust problem, because it's not only your inspectors that have to be trained. Presumably, if we're counting on the facilities mm-hmm. to do this work, they've also got to be trained, and their eyeballs also have to be calibrated.
Yeah, this is one aspect of our whole toolbox of enforcement actions we could take on a facility. We can put out fallout plates for something like a night problem where we'll put it downwind, see if we can get some fallouts and take it to the lab to see if we can fingerprint it back to the facility. We've been experimenting with some technologies for visualizing dust, cameras, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. that you can take pictures, and then it could be then translated by somebody who's certified to look at that. The problem is that reading dust violations is a difficult thing. It's an art and a science both. Sometimes a plume just doesn't necessarily come out. Sometimes the wind, it doubles up on each other. It doubles up. It looks denser than it is depending on the sun angle and that sort of, and the refractive properties of the particles themselves. So there's a lot of technology there, but there's also a lot of art there. So we've been looking at all those.
How about a hybrid approach that would take advantage mm-hmm. of some of this technology? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know when you do a highly calibrated test, you pump a certain amount of air containing particulate matter through a filter, you weigh the filter mm-hmm. before and after, and you determine it. And that's a very labor-intensive process, mm-hmm. and you bring air samples back to this facility. But I was thinking about technology that might give you a clue as to where you have, you know, probable violations or issues, and then you could, be more efficiently mm-hmm. allocating your expert manpower to the...
Yeah, I think
for the sites that really as John says, right, a disconnect between the timing of the thing that creates the dust and the observances and all of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of other factors, too, that have to take into account. You know, if it's a point source, top of a pile, that pile mm-hmm. stays the same place all the time, you know, that's pretty easy to do. Mm-hmm. These things do move around. There are various points within a facility that this dust and or particulates could be generated. So it's just the nature of the source itself and how good it can do that. Through our violation process, through other things, we can require facilities to do additional monitoring, specific time monitoring, that sort of thing. So I think we get to there. It's just that it's hard to write a rule to specify it for every type of facility or every type of property available.
Thank you.
So do you want to show something from that last slide or not?
Dust from various processes.
Right.
So here's the some ways to control that kind of dust. The wind screens, and these are things that are in place in the Bay Area right now. Mist systems, those kind of approaches are very effective. The mist system is particularly effective, but the wind screens can be very effective too if they're properly designed. So the next rule is Regulation 6, Rule 6, Prohibition of Track Out. Now, this is typically required for storm pollution prevention plans, and it's also required under the California Motor Vehicle Code. But in our review of large construction sites and materials handling sites, we found that it would be beneficial to put some additional enforcement horsepower behind this. So the road dust has high PM2.5 content. Like I said, our observation of the construction sites, it said that about half of them had some kind of track out issue. So the requirement in this rule is no significant visible material on the roadway. Zero is too hard to enforce, and so we came up with some measures in coordination with Mr. Keno's staff on things that would make sense, be easy for them to enforce. So the operator is required to prevent dust during cleanup and to monitor twice daily. We expect about 0.2 tons per day PM2.5 reduction from this rule. And going back, here's some pictures of track out in the Bay Area. And you can see that it's quite significant in some cases and pretty easy to trace back to the source. So one good way to address track out are these grizzly bars, which shake the truck down, shake the mud off the wheels. The problem is sometimes those things get filled up with mud, at which point they're no longer useful. And so the operator will be required to keep those clean. And the truck wash system that hit to wash the trucks down before they leave is also another good way to control track out. Once again, we're not taking a prescriptive approach in this rule. We don't want to force people to use a lot of water given the persistent drought that we have in the Bay Area. So we want to be performance-based and let them take the best approach for their particular site. So we conducted 8 workshops in the early part of this year. Comments were received in March. We've been incorporating changes, and we're conducting the CEQA and socioeconomic analysis, and we expect to have a public hearing in November. The goal is to get the draft package out to the public for their comments late December, early January. So next steps for PM. Some of the biggest sources of PM2.5 in the Bay Area are fluidized catalytic cracking units at refineries. We passed a rule, Rule 6.5, a couple of years ago to address that. And the results have been mixed. We need to take another look at that and see if additional requirements aren't necessary for those fluid catalytic cracking units. As Director Sinks knows, we've been working with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment on a risk characterization for PM. Right now, there are health values for diesel PM, but not for other kinds of PM. And having those risk values will help us do something along the lines of Rule 18. We could do a PM risk-based rule if we had those health values from OEHA. We may also need to do source-specific regulations based on sources identified in highly impacted communities as we review them under AB 617. This may also come up in the AB 617 BARCT review. We're required to look at all facilities under cap and trade, look at all the sources of those facilities, and make sure that all those sources have best available retrofit control technology installed, and we expect there'll be some PM rules that come out of that. We're also looking at our permitting rules to see if they need to be changed, evaluate some options to address the localized health impacts of PM. Right now, our permitting rule treats PM as a regional pollutant, and there are local impacts as well, so we want to make sure that we're addressing that in our permitting program, and we're beginning that process now. And that concludes my presentation. I'll take any questions you might have.
Great. Questions before we go to speakers? Yes. Yes. Carol? Carol, and then.
Thank you. Yes. I'd like to follow up on Director Sinks. Do we have enough inspectors? And are their schedules flexible enough that they can respond quickly, or if something appears to be amiss, they have a chance to change their schedule and get there instead of 2 or 3 days later?
Well, you're asking somebody who used to run the enforcement division, so obviously, you know, staffing, we'd always like more staffing. But to answer your question, we do have flexible schedules. We have an extensive on-call standby system that we do so we can respond 24/7. So we do have all those processes in place. Would we like, could we respond quicker? Would we like to? Yes, but we, you know, we balance everything here.
Oh, well, maybe I'll ask Mr. Broadbent then. I mean, are we going to look at this when we do our next budget?
Yes, Director Groom. This is part of our examination of our staffing resources for the budget. We are going through, I think we just hired five, if I recall, just five, but I think those five replace vacancies. And we're looking to augment the staff for the next budget, too, as well, Director.
Excellent. Johnson. Thank you.
Liz?
So going way back to slide 16, the one that says draft the structure for Regulation 6. Right. And I think what you said in this was we are looking at this now so that we can tighten up on other PMs later. Is that correct?
This is a cleanup of our old PM rules, and we want to get this done first to, so that we've got a strong foundation for building those source-specific rules later.
So what do you see us doing on the next couple of steps?
That will... Blue catalytic cracking units are a big priority. Coke and coal handling facilities are a possibility. As we look at these, at all of the sources in cap and trade under AB 617, we might find some sources that need to be updated, have their requirements updated. As we do a dive down into the facilities that are in overburdened communities, we may identify other sources that need to be controlled to address the inequity in those areas.
So, but do you see another rule coming up? Is that what you're looking at?
Several.
Okay. So several rules will come up
over the next few years, yeah.
That all relate to PM?
Yes.
Both 2.5 and 10?
We're going to focus on PM 2.5. We think we've got the PM 10 stuff fairly well covered in
okay.
this. Okay. We've been in compliance with the PM 10 standard for a long time.
And the 2.5 is the one that we have been most concerned about as far as health concerns.
That's correct.
Good. Thanks.
Okay. Jim.
In your discussion on the self-monitoring, is there any discussion about video monitoring or video recording an operation for 30 days? And, you know, so if there's violations, you can review that, and that would be part of that self. I mean, it seems like that's a modest investment that would be very revealing.
We do have some video monitoring on certain facilities, but we haven't, because of the nature of where the emissions are, we haven't really discussed it on these types of sources. What I did fail to mention is that through this rule development process, what this rule does is it says visible dust going outside the property line. So what that, before it was a certain density of material that had to be, you know, a certain opacity that had to be emitted from the source, and only our inspectors who are certified could actually enforce that. The facility really couldn't do it. So now what this rule does is it gives the facility a way of determining their compliance or not themselves. So it's sort of it gives them certainty. They'll know when they're compliant or not just by looking with their normal eye. They don't have to be certified. So I think that's what these rules do, is that it gives the facilities an opportunity to determine their compliance themselves and not have to be told by a third party.
Yeah, I was just thinking if you could have the video recording, like, the chair's comments, if most of their business is between 10 and 3, and you visually see all this traffic, and they're monitoring, you know, it's 7 at 5, you know, it gives us some guidelines. Mm-hmm. I hope that we're really looking at technology instead of just hiring this big staff, you know, that we look at ways that we can get good data without that burden of a large staff or of inspectors.
So just following up on that, so you, I mean, you've summarized in these slides the rule, but we haven't seen the draft language. So it would be useful, it would be useful to understand the draft language and to ensure that it addresses the concerns that we're talking about here as specifically as possible. I mean, I understand that we have enforcement staff. You know, sometimes they're, you know, they can get out to things quicker than other times. But it seems to me the clearer it is in the rule to address these issues, the stronger basis we're on as we're in, you know, our inspectors are out there. I'd like to see the language.
The language has been out to the public at least once.
Right.
So
I mean,
far.
To us, to see, to maybe have some with us.
We can provide that to you.
Is the language on the website now?
The previous version was. It's not the current version. We're pushing the board package through the management review process right now.
It would be useful, though, to have the language. Normally, we see, you know, draft rule language before it shows up at the. That's the purpose of the discussion here, right? Is to address these issues.
Right, Mr. Chairman. It's not expected to get to you for the full board consideration until February, so there's some time here. It's going to go through management review, as Greg indicated. And as soon as that's completed, we'll be sending it
should
out.
Should we have the draft language back if there's a stationary source committee sometime in, later in January or before
right,
the board
January,
meeting?
Right, it'll be January, because always in the management review, there's changes.
And then maybe have the draft language out when you have the next update to our board. How's that?
Okay. That, and probably maybe, before the retreat.
And address how you're dealing with these issues. I mean, several of us have pointed out, we want to be really clear that we're not just leaving it up to them to sort of self-monitor. We're, I get performance-based is a good thing, assuming we collect the data and are able to hold them to that.
Right. So, Mr. Chairman, I heard that comment, and let us take that back because I think there's some things we can do to shore up the proposed reg a little bit with regard to maybe not leaving so much to the facility. We've heard that.
Right, yes. Okay. So we have several speakers, and then we can always come back for more comments after the speakers. Each speaker has 3 minutes. Minda Berbeco, followed by Richard Gray, followed by Jed Holtzman, Charles Davidson, and Janet Stromberg. Those are the speakers.
Ah, there we go. Thank you very much. I'm Minda Berbeco. I'm the director of the San Francisco Bay chapter of the Sierra Club. We're really pleased to see that you're addressing particulate matter. Our concern, though, is specifically in Rule 6.1 and how it can help reduce health impacts to communities around the Levin Richmond Coal and Petcoke Terminal in Richmond. Of interest to us are concerns that were brought up by multiple board members here, actually. What is being monitored? Is it dust or particulate matter specifically? We're concerned with particulate matter. How it's being monitored? Is it visual or is it using sensors? It sounds like that's an issue that's shared. We would prefer sensors. And by whom is it being monitored? Is it BACMET staff or is the staff of the facility? And obviously we have a preference there too. There are legitimate concerns that seem not to have been addressed here, and that's concerning to us. But we're hopeful that they'll be addressed in the next iteration of this rule, and we're looking forward to it being released soon so that we can all review it. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Gray?
Good morning, directors. Richard Gray with 350 Bay Area. I'm also somebody who lives in one of the wood smoke capitals of the Bay Area, Forest Knolls in Marin County. We really appreciate the interest of the directors and the fact that the staff has led an effort to severely reduce PM from wood smoke in our area. We definitely need a backstop for PM 2.5. It should be regulated as a criteria pollutant and be handled as a priority since it's the most dangerous to the health in the Bay Area community. As we said at the last board meeting, trading for PM 2.5 pollution must be ended. It is completely at odds with the district's responsibility to protect the health of the areas most polluted. Please also prioritize reduction of coal dust released into our communities as it arrives by train or in open, uncovered piles of petcoke and coal. Looking for clouds of dust is not exactly what we have in mind, especially if the polluter is doing the monitoring. So it's encouraging to hear Jack say that they're going to take another look at that. Or when the materials are not being handled or moved, or when they're moved at night. Thank you, Director Joya and Sinks, for zeroing in on this issue. I just want to add, please make sure that you have adequate resources and technology devoted to monitoring and compliance, since this is one of the most important actions you can take to protect health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jed Holtzman.
Thank you, Chair Joy and directors. Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. Thanks to the staff. A lot to say. I will go really fast. This was in the 2010 Clean Air Plan, as your staff showed, and it was also in the 2017 Clean Air Plan. So we've been working on this for a long time. We're very supportive of very stringent controls on fine particulate pollution. If you look on slide 11, you can see that the fine particulate matter from residential wood burning is equivalent to the industrial sector. This says to me that we really must electrify this residential heating, especially for folks with sole source of heat, as wood, and we should incentivize that by allowing them to leapfrog other polluting technologies that release PM2.5 by simply taking them from wood burning to electrification. If you go to the next slide, as far as the bulk material handling controls that your staff described, the PM2.5 from industrial and commercial processes, if you add up those numbers, is about 3.8 tons per day, and we saw that the rule would reduce about 0.03 tons per day, which is less than 1% of the PM2.5 from that sector. The track out different pool that we're pulling from, different total, but about the similar proportion in terms of what we would be expecting to reduce from these rules. In addition, I would just say we really have to stop with half measures or quarter measures or eighth measures or 16th measures at this point. If we're all kind of on the same page that folks are dying and we don't want them to, then it's unclear to me why we would take such small bites at the apple when we've been talking about this since 2010. In that vein, we think that this rule needs to call right now for open piles of hazardous materials to be covered and enclosed, not just when a facility is applying for a new permit and thus subject to BACT. We have known for years that these things are damaging. We've known for years that they need to be covered, and in fact, they are covered in practice in other parts of the Bay Area. So there's really no reason why we should have these distributional effects in localized public health. Ultimately, a risk-based rule, in the next steps, talking about an 1118 style rule for PM, a risk-based rule will require the completion of this kind of risk characterization that we're talking about, which we could expect to take quite a while. It also locks in a certain number of dead people per year and from avoidable human activity, and it doesn't really need to be this way. So I think we would prefer that PM be regulated as a pollutant that we are, you know, trying to reduce to a zero level, not a 10 people per year or 25 people per year dying from human activity that could be avoided. A basin-wide combustion strategy, which has been discussed in the Clean Air Plan for greenhouse gases, should be addressed to PM, and that should be our way forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Charles Davidson.
Greetings, staff and board. Thank you, Mr. Sinks, for being attending the Technical Advisory Committee meeting. When Dr. Kleinman was speaking, he did say that brown carbon, which is black carbon with volatile organic gases and liquids, are more toxic than typical black carbon. They also said that various transition metals that produce destructive free radicals in biological tissues also make black carbon, when it's adhered to the particle, more toxic biologically. Regarding the burning of petroleum coke at refineries, this goes on at all refineries. I've been repeatedly denied that such petroleum coke is burned at refineries. I have evidence here I wanted to send to everybody, and I would like to discuss one comment that was recently in the newspaper that the Indian government has banned the burning of petroleum coke in the three states around New Delhi. And that is because of toxic health effects. And also, I'd like to discuss the various heavy metals in petroleum coke combustion that goes on at refineries. That they recently, a Duke University study has shown that the Human emissions of potentially harmful trace metal vanadium into Earth's atmosphere spiked sharply at the start of the 20th century, due in large part to industry's growing use of heavy oils, tar sands, and petroleum coke for energy. And this has increased mostly in the last two decades and mostly in the 20th century because of India and China's industrialization process, 170%. So most of that 170% in the last two decades has been within the last 10 or 15 years. I would like to, I made a mistake the other day, but I'd like to clarify when I was talking about the carbon plant on Highway 4 that burns 0.5 million tons of petroleum coke per year from the Phillips 66 refinery. That's 90 truckloads per day. I have evidence here, a letter from the EPA dated 2008, and I put the page number on here that says minimum 20% of petroleum coke is combusted in the calcining process, and that's what goes on at the carbon plant on Highway 4. So, and up to 30%. So we're talking about if there's 500,000 tons, that means that 100,000 tons of petroleum coke goes up the chimney in either as greenhouse gases or as particulate matter. Their chimney stack is black on there. So, and that is exactly about 250 yards from people's house. And I have other evidence that shows how much petroleum coke or vanadium is in petroleum coke and bitumen and tar sands, and I will submit those. Thank you very much.
Janet Stromberg is our last speaker.
Good morning, Chair Joy and members of the committee. I, as you know, I used to work here, and I know that these PM rules, Regulation 6 rules have been underway for 4 years. I know that a previous draft of these rules included requirements to be monitoring for PM2.5 and PM10, which is apparently not in the draft that's going to come out. In these 4 years, a lot of monitoring could have been happening in order to gather the data necessary to set some minimum backstop standards for these pollutants. Another thing is that if you want to just Google pet coke bulk storage in bulk terminal in Pittsburgh, you can find a picture of an extremely clean, comparatively, storage facility totally enclosed for bulk pet coke. So this is it should be a barked rule already. It's long past overdue. And it seems to me it would be possible in a backstop rule to set some sort of criteria for when these enclosures need to be required. And given the fact that the public has been coming at this district to control petroleum-based emissions from refineries for so many years, and the work was begun on this rule so many years ago, it's really disheartening that what you're going to be given in April is really a nothing burger. It's a rule just catching us up with the other requirements already in place in California, and I find it quite disturbing. Likewise, with fluid catalytic crackers, it's well known that the secondary pollutants there, the particulates, have been undercounted, and the ability to measure those and to control those has been within our grasp for many, many years. And so this kicking the can down the road and creating this space for more time for everything to happen, it's really time for, I believe, the board members to really own these things. And as previous speakers have said, continue to regulate PM2.5 as a criteria pollutant and continue to look at what the exposures are, what the actual emissions are, what the monitors are saying, and get those numbers down. We know they need to be going down. We know there's no safe exposure to PM, according to the science, according to the health officials. So you really can't do a risk reduction on something at which there's been no proven safe health standard. So that's my comment for this, and another plug for getting going on the combustion strategy, which would address all of this. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last speaker. Anyone else wish to speak? Okay, bringing it back to the board. Comments from board members, and Jack, maybe response to some of the comments that we heard.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So as Mr. Nutt indicated, these changes to these rules are really just trying to clean up some fairly old rules that we have on the books, make them more enforceable. We are going to take back some of the comments we've heard from the board, see what we can do in terms of tightening up some of the approaches that are being proposed here. I do believe there's a conversation that needs to occur in terms of what technology is available that could support essentially ambient concentrations of PM that are generated locally from some of these sources, what can be done to understand them better and ensure that they can be used to help mitigate off-site PM in the communities. And so I'd like the opportunity to go back and take a look at that as well and see what can or could be incorporated as part of this rulemaking. It may be that we need to take that a little, it may take a little bit longer, but I've heard that comment as well. So good feedback to the staff this morning, Mr. Chairman. There's just a lot there, but we're still going to move ahead. We still think it's important to move ahead
and
with these.
And you'll come back and with draft language and
yes,
and specifically how some of these issues will be addressed right. For the next update. Any other comments by board members?
Well, I just wanted to talk to Director Sparing's idea. I mean, video these days, a 4K camera that, you know, sits on a bicycle helmet costs almost nothing. So really, it's the cost of the infrastructure. If your rule said you have to put, you may already have surveillance cameras around a valuable industrial facility. Maybe if that surveillance camera footage was available to Air District staffers on demand, we might get more accurate reporting.
Right.
And if they've already made the investment to bring the, you know, the communications and power infrastructure to places around the fence line, it would seem to me that you might be able to tell a whole lot from that, and somebody could, looking for problems, could either at the facility, because that's what our rule said, or an inspector could fast forward through that at 10 or 20x and see a whole day's worth of dust in a 20 minutes instead of watching it.
I want to make sure the committee understands we have had and deployed video capabilities now for many years. That's not something that is a new concept to us. But there's a fairly significant leap then to use that technology for enforcement purposes. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about penalties and fines and being able to then have that withstand the scrutiny as through court. So that's really what's the issue.
I get all that. And where I'm coming from is, you know, if you're looking for a few needles in a haystack,
right,
having technology to sort of point you where those needles might be,
right,
even if, you know, the first time it happens, it's not enforceable, it's pretty clear to the person at the plant whose job it is to look through this that there's a problem there. Well, they may clean it up themselves. Great. If it's a persistent problem, then at least an inspector knows, you know, is more likely to know when and which facilities, right? It's the idea of narrowing it down so that when you do need to take enforcement action, you've got the right person at the right place at the right time.
And I think the point you're making is that the camera wouldn't be itself used as an enforcement proceeding, but an assistance to our inspectors to ensure that the monitoring is going on at the right time.
It's just leveraging.
And there's nothing that prevents that. Right, so if it's another set of eyes and ears in a sense to sort of verify, as I think as Rod says, finding that needle in the haystack, and it's now with the technology that exists for cameras often, it's there, it's usable, it's feasible, and then that allows your folks to say, well, the monitoring's not occurring at the right time, then they only have a fine or a penalty after.
It's designed to be able to trigger additional steps by the staff.
Just like the ground level monitoring, fence line monitoring that some refineries have today that were put in with various agreements, while those can't be used for enforcement, they're used for collecting information, right, that can be helpful to take other steps.
Right. So that's what I took to mean that the discussion here today. We'll take that back.
Yes. Thanks.
David.
I just wanted to ask Jack a question. So the technology we currently use, is it real time? So, like, do we have third-party access? Or how is, if you could explain sort of how the technology currently works in terms of the video.
Yes, the places where we do have video monitoring in place, I'll give you an example, Lehigh Stack, flares in the district, that is real time to the operators, but not to us. So we would have to go back and review all that video to find out when, you know, something happened. Usually that's triggered from either looking at plant parameters that are the plant's operating at and or getting complaints on a facility. So we then go ahead and take a look at the video at that point.
Got it. Is there, and Jack, I don't know, you may know more about this than I or, you know, Wayne, but is there, is there like a third-party waiver that can be established that where the facility operator gives us 24-hour, 7-day access, and obviously it's not, you know, to monitor it basically. And so what that would essentially do is we would be able to use, as you know, through a third-party waiver, we'd be able to view what takes place, whether it's 4 hours before or 5 hours before. I think what Mr. Sinks is saying, I think is really important. And if we can leverage that technology in an advantageous way, obviously Ms. Groom had spoken about the inspectors and how many inspectors do we have. But I think if we were to utilize this correctly, I think it'd be beneficial to both us, but I think it would be beneficial to those companies. So it's just something to consider.
Okay. Brad?
Jack, what I understood you to say, and I'm just making sure, you would like to bring back a kind of a discussion around showing us about what technology can be done to help us on our activity that we're trying to do here.
Right. I think I've heard enough today that makes me think that I want to sit down and talk to staff and see what we can do in terms of shoring up some of the requirements here. I still want to make sure we bring this for the full board consideration sometime in the first quarter of next year. But there could be some shoring up, I believe, of some of the enforcement procedures and then also the integration of technology. So
that's,
it would
that's
make,
what I'm interested in seeing, that integration
right, and
of
I think
technology.
It, maybe it might make sense for us to agendize a stationary source committee.
Good. Thank
talk
you.
About that.
Can I ask just one more question on the issue of sort of, you know, using technology for measurements? Is there, you know, we've passed rules, you know, 1215, which focuses on measurements around refineries, and of course, then we're under Assembly Bill 617, we're going to be doing more sort of robust monitoring. Is there sort of state-of-the-art technology that really picks up and measures PM near these facilities?
Director Joy, the problem that we have with some of the low-cost PM technology is that it has a laser that counts particles, and it can't differentiate between dust or water or coke and coal or water. So it's not really useful in...
What about the expensive stuff? We're not talking about the cheap stuff here.
Yeah, no, the expensive...
We are a big air district.
The expensive stuff is very expensive. And Jack mentioned LDAR and, you know, some of the dial projects that I have seen run $500,000 to $1 million a day.
A day?
A day.
So though, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like the opportunity to do is really building on Mr. Director Wagenknecht's point, and that is let's schedule in a stationary source committee so we can walk you through the type of technologies that are available. Mm-hmm. I think you'd find it, one, fascinating. At least we would as staff. Maybe you all wouldn't. But then... and then you can see where, because it's continually evolving, and it's actually evolving in a great space for us, and it's just a matter of just how much investment do we want to make in this area to augment mm-hmm. our current processes. And I think it'd be informative, educational, if you will. And let us try to schedule that in the next couple of months.
All right. Anything else on this item? All right. Thank you. That was good discussion. Item 5 is Regulation 11, Rule 18, Implementation Update.
Good morning, Chair Joy, members of the Station Resource Committee. This morning we have a brief informational update for you on where we are with Regulation 11, Rule 18. As you know, this is a major item for implementation for us over the next year. So we just want to kind of lay out some initial steps that we're taking to get structurally set up to perform the work that we need to do here. And then we will be more than likely giving you an update a little bit further out into the next calendar year. But we didn't want you to think that work had slowed or stalled on this. And this will show you where we're headed. And Caroline, our supervisor in our engineering division, will take you through where we're at.
So good morning, Chairman Joya and members of the Stationary Source Committee. I'm Carol Allen, a supervisor in the Air District's Engineering Division. Thank you and all of the board members for taking a bold step on November 15th and adopting Regulation 11, Rule 18. This rule will improve air quality in our most vulnerable communities by reducing health risks resulting from toxic air contaminant emissions from existing facilities. I'm pleased to be here today to give you an update on our implementation plans for Rule 11-18. During my presentation this morning, I will give you a quick review of Rule 11-18 and describe the actions we have taken to date to prepare for implementation of this rule. As you will see, determining a site's potential health impacts on the surrounding community is a key early step in the implementation process for this rule. The Air District will need assistance from consultants to complete these health risk assessments as quickly as possible. I will describe the procedures we use to identify qualified health risk assessment consulting firms and provide a list of our authorized health risk assessment vendors. Last, I'll go over our next steps for implementation for 2018. Rule 11-18 uses health risk-based thresholds to determine if facilities are subject to the risk reduction requirements of this rule. Therefore, the Air District must first determine the facility-wide health impacts from individual facilities. The Air District will use the current air toxic hotspots screening procedure, called the prioritization score, to determine which sites will require a facility-wide health risk assessment. Facilities with a prioritization score greater than 250 will be evaluated during the first phase of Rule 11-18 implementation. Facilities with a prioritization score greater than 10 will be evaluated during the second phase of implementation. If the health risk impacts from a facility exceed the risk action levels, and I'll talk more about those in a minute, the facility must develop a risk reduction plan, seek Air District approval of this plan, and then implement the risk reduction measures in their plan. Facilities will achieve compliance with Rule 11-18 by either reducing their health impacts below the final risk action thresholds or by installing best available retrofit control technology, or TBARCT, on all significant sources of health risk. Rule 11-18 has two sets of risk action thresholds. The first set of risk action thresholds is a cancer risk of 25 in a million, a non-cancer chronic hazard index of 2.5, or an acute hazard index of 2.5. These levels are effective now and until January 1, 2020. If a facility is found to have health impacts that equal or exceed any one of these risk action levels, the facility must submit and implement their risk reduction plan. The second set of risk action levels, a cancer risk of 10 in a million and hazard indices of 1.0, will become effective on January 1, 2020 and will apply to the second implementation phase. These are the sites with a prioritization score greater than 10 but less than 250. A risk reduction plan requirements are the same. As you all know, Rule 11-18 was adopted on November 15th. However, the Air District has been laying the groundwork for this rule for quite a while now. In anticipation of Rule 1118, the Air District realized that consultants would likely be needed to assist with the preparation of site-wide health risks for existing facilities due to the large amount of input data required and the complexity of these analyses. Therefore, Air District issued a request for qualifications in 2016 to identify qualified health risk assessment consulting firms. Next, I'll discuss this RFQ process, the review criteria, and the results. On November 16, 2016, the Air District issued a request for qualifications, or RFQ, for health risk assessment services to support our toxic risk reduction regulations. We sent the RFQ to over 200 consulting and university contacts. We provided opportunities for vendors to submit questions, and we posted answers to these questions on the website.
Are these dates a year off?
No, they're not. This was actually
did oh, this was paper in 2016. Before. Got it. Oh, mm-hmm. I see. Yes.
We provided opportunities for vendors. Oh, we said that. The RFQ proposals were due on December 8th, 2016. The Air District received proposals from 12 HRA consultants, and a panel of Air District staff evaluated these proposals in January of 2017. The panel evaluated each RFQ proposal on the basis of the firm's expertise at conducting risk assessments for a variety of industries and familiarity with Air District HRA procedures, the experience of staff, approach for complex facilities, and demonstration of the ability to provide these HRA services, cost of the services, and other criteria such as ownership by underrepresented people, agreed business certification, or local firms. The largest emphasis was placed on expertise and approach, which accounted for up to 70% of the total score. The average of the panel scores for each review criterion and the total score for each firm are presented here. The firms are ranked by total score, with the highest score at the top of the table. Air District staff believes that the top six firms have the necessary qualifications to conduct site-wide health risk assessments. It's important to have a variety of firms available so that we can choose the best firm for a particular type of facility or industry while avoiding conflict of interest issues. The Air District's six authorized health risk assessment consultants are listed here. The APCO will negotiate terms and execute contracts with these firms as needed to support Rule 1118. Please note that these will be no-cost contracts. The cost of HRA services will be recovered by fees charged to the affected facilities pursuant to Regulation 3. For the smaller non-Title V facilities, the Air District will normally conduct the site's health risk assessment on their behalf. However, if they prefer, a site may choose to contract directly with one of these firms to conduct the site-wide HRA. And last, I'd like to go over our next steps. First, we will be refining our Phase 1 facility list and choose the first 20 high-impact facilities that will undergo site-wide health risk assessments. These first 20 facilities will be notified that the Air District is beginning the review and verification process for their emission inventory and HRA input data. We're also building the additional infrastructure that we need to properly track and review these health risk assessments. We are working on tools for collecting and storing the HRA input data, reporting formats for consultants, general modeling protocols, and health risk assessment refinement criteria. In the spring and summer of 2018, we will need to identify specific consultants for individual facilities and execute those contracts. We will also be forming the Technical Dispute Resolution Committee. In the first half of 2018, we will be reviewing and approving the emission inventories and the HRA input data for the first 20 facilities. Engineering staff will work closely with facilities during this review. Consultants will be submitting the modeling protocols for Air District approval. In the fall of 2018, we expect consultants to begin submitting completed health risk assessments for Air District review. Once the Air District has approved the HRAs, the draft reports will be made available for public comment, and after considering and responding to comments, the final results will be published on our website. And that's my update for today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yeah. Karen?
Thank you. I know you all have done a lot of work on this, but in looking at the timetable, you reviewed these proposals almost a year ago. So my concern or question is there going to be any... First of all, I take it that these companies all knew that we hadn't, we were going through a lot with Rule 1118, and so they were sort of, they knew to be on hold. I'm concerned how can we ascertain that nothing has changed in these 12 months?
So as we brought this item forward and as we had this conversation, as you adopted the rule, we went back to each of these consultants through our RFP process, which allows us to do that, RFQ process, but sorry. Basically, we've confirmed with each of these firms that the highest scoring firms, they're still willing to do the work. They're still willing to do it along the time frames and the way that they submitted those proposals. So basically, those submittals are still good.
They still meet the criteria that, in other words, after staff got back in touch with them after we adopted, you went over and was there a process? How did you confirm that they still met the criteria?
Their scoring wouldn't change under the RFP. Their submittals, they basically provided a proposal, and what we've asked them to do as part of that is, will you honor that proposal? And the answer in each case was yes.
Okay, so obviously their expertise has stayed the same, their experience, their approach, so it's basically the cost, and they're confirming that even a year later they will abide
Correct.
By what they did. All right. And that they meet the other of minority-owned, veteran, women, and certified green. You were able to confirm that?
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
So just on clarification, the just the slide that shows the
farther back.
The process with the consultants who prepare the HRAs. So have we determined which facilities we're doing the HRAs and which facility types of facilities the consultants will be doing the HRAs? We had discussion about that.
Your direction to us was is that for all Title V facilities, for major impacted facilities, the Air District would do those HRAs, and we had the option then to use consultants to do that. So these consultants would qualify for that. And then for non-Title V facilities, the smaller facilities, they have the option of either asking us to do it or picking off this list.
I think there was a lot of open discussion at the board about that.
Mr. Chairman, right. Let me add to Mr. Breen's remarks, though. If you recall, there's going to be an implementation committee formed.
Yes.
We're still in the process of doing that. This was an issue.
In which this will get discussed.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. All right. I think that was clear.
And we plan to bring 1118 back to the Stationary Source Committee on routine basis next year.
Because I don't think we determine with a level of 100% certainty, specifically with regard to the refineries, whether it was the consultants or the district, that we were setting up an implementation committee to address that issue, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Anything else? All right. That's the last committee member comments. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Enjoy time and place of the next meeting.
Hopefully see you all on Wednesday.
Wednesday. Oh, that's right. We'll see you Wednesday. Okay. Not right.
Right. Carol, good job.